Arkansans head to the polls next week for a slate of special elections. A celebration of a civil rights leader's 111th birthday takes place at her historic home in Little Rock. Plus, a look at the history behind a controversial execution method. Those stories and more are coming up this week on the News Wrap from the Arkansas Newsroom. I'm Daniel Breen, News Director of Little Rock Public Radio. Each week, we're recapping the top stories from all across the Natural State. We'll unpack the headlines, share exclusive insights, and provide the context you need to fully grasp the issues that matter most to Arkansans. That's this week on the Arkansas News Wrap, coming up right after the news from NPR. This is the Arkansas News Wrap. I'm Daniel Breen with Little Rock Public Radio. While the 2026 midterms are still roughly a year away, a handful of special elections will be taking place in Arkansas next Tuesday. Kristen Nederstrom-Higgins is a program associate at the Public Policy Center for the University of Arkansas System Division of Agriculture. She spoke with KUAF's Matthew Moore to break down where Arkansans will be heading to the polls next week.
We're looking at a couple different kinds of special elections across the state. Let's start with specifically with cities who have special elections. I'm looking at your great newsletter here, the News and Notes, the Arkansas Ballot Issues, and we'll have a link to sign up for that. But we've got special elections in Bella Vista, Conway, Greenland, Ozark, Sherwood, and Texarkana coming up next week.
And those are the ones that we know of, because there's not a central database of special elections at the local level. And so we comb through newspapers, we go through Facebook pages for election commissions, people send us election information. So this is our best attempt at compiling what we know is taking place. And we see a variety of different types of elections happening at the city level. So we have a referendum in Ozark. The city council there passed an entertainment district ordinance, and there were enough local residents who were concerned and didn't want that entertainment district. So they went out and they collected signatures from voters in the area to put that ordinance on the ballot for the voters to decide whether or not they'll have an entertainment district. Greenland, I believe, is an annexation. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of see the variety of different types of elections, the different types of questions that voters have to decide. One of the more popular ones, of course, are sales tax elections, bond issues. So bond issue is when, you know, they want to build like a really big project. It could be a water park. It could be a community center. It could be a police station. And the only way to pay for that up front is through a bond issue. And then you would have either a property tax or a sales tax corresponding with that to pay off that debt over time.
And so the reason to have the election this November in 2025 instead of waiting until 2026 in a normal election cycle is because you want the money faster, right?
Right. So if you're doing a property tax, then you have to wait an entire year for that tax because we, you know, tax a year behind. And so that would be, you know, a year and a half before they would have any income coming in. Same thing with a sales tax. You know, they might say, well, we could wait until next year, but things would just get more expensive. And so if we start it now, there's usually, depending on when the election is, you know, the sales tax might not start for 2 months. So for example, we're voting in November, it would be January before things would take effect.
Mm, got it. We're also looking at a few different school districts across the state with special elections. What differs between, say, a city sales tax and a school district property tax, which is a lot of what we're looking at here?
Right. Well, with the property tax elections, again, that is a school district might want to build. In these instances, there's a new high school proposed, like an entire campus. There's pre-K building being proposed in one community. And so these are large construction projects. And again, the best way to do that for them and the authority that they have for school districts is the property tax, right? So the school district can't go out and increase your sales tax, but they can ask you to vote on a millage. That's what we call it, a millage rate. I always just call it a property tax because that's a little bit more
common
everyday talking. We don't talk about millages all the time. For them, that's a way to get that money up front, very similar to a home mortgage. So you pay that off over time. And so that money is available as soon as they can sell a bond pay for the construction up front. So we see, again, just that is the vehicle that school districts have, whereas cities and counties have sales tax as well as property tax open to them.
There are also two special elections that are being litigated in the courts right now, a House district in Pulaski County and a Senate district in the Arkansas River Valley. Those are still being litigated at this point. There's not really anything you and I can really talk about that hasn't changed or will change by the time this gets on the air.
Yeah, those elections are supposed to be slated for next year anyway, because they involve candidates, where these ones are, again, sales tax, property tax, millage, bond issues. We have a couple of county elections. I think one is for law enforcement. Another one is for the for road department. So, I mean, there's all these different issues that county government and local government are dealing with that have nothing to do with candidates.
Speaking of elections next year, we are going to see some ballot measures on the 2026 ballot here in Arkansas. Some of those will be legislatively referred, right?
Right. So right now we only have the legislatively referred amendments. The Arkansas legislature earlier this year voted to place three proposed constitutional amendments on the 2026 ballot. And then there's also a bond issue question in addition to those. And so those are definitely on the ballot next November. And then right now we have a couple different citizen groups going around. One is collecting signatures. Two of the groups are involved in a federal lawsuit just over the changes to the citizen initiative process. And depending on the outcome of that lawsuit, or there's like a temporary restraining order request going on with that one, depending on the outcome of that decision, we might see more groups come forward. There are a couple that have already had their ballot titles certified by the Attorney General. And you might remember, like, that's the first step. They have to get that ballot title certified by the Attorney General's office before they can go collect signatures. And so we have one group that wants to remove sales tax from period products, another group that wants to do they want to pass education policy that would make any school that receives public funding have to go by the same standards as public schools. And then we have another group that is working on the citizen initiative process and a competing proposal or a complementary proposal. They do something, each do a little different, but it's still related to the citizen initiative process. So we've got those out there percolating, as well as one that was just proposed by University of Arkansas students. But that proposal hasn't made it through the Attorney General's office yet.
Right. So let's do a quick explanation of, it's not enough to just come up with a proposal and get it onto the ballot. It has to be certified by the Attorney General. What does that process look like broadly?
Well, you put together a ballot title, and that's what voters see when they go to vote. It gives them a summary of the constitutional amendment or proposed state law that's before them. And in addition to that ballot title, you provide the full text. So in this case, a constitutional amendment, you would provide the full, like, here's what this amendment will do, here's what it will change, or here's what it will add. And that's not text that you see on the ballot itself. So you give both of those documents to the Attorney General's office, and they go over it. They go, you know, is this free of misleading language or partisan or coloring language? Is this accurate? You know, are there spelling errors, grammatical errors? Because, you know, commas do matter. That can change a policy quickly. And so they go over and just, like, look to see. And then new this year is the eighth grade reading level for ballot titles. And only if you meet all of those check boxes does your title get certified for circulation. And that's just a way to describe that once you get that official certification is when you can go collect the first voter signature.
And so the one that we were just speaking about, where a collection of University of Arkansas students have drafted what they're calling the Clean and Healthy Natural Environment Amendment. That one has not been certified by the Attorney General at this point.
Right. So they've done it twice now. They've attempted twice. The first attempt, it didn't meet the eighth grade reading requirement. And they went and again made some tweaks and brought that back. And the Attorney General's opinion that came out saying it just, it was rejected. It said that some of the language in there needed some clarifying. So when you're talking about governmental entities, which governmental entities? If you're talking about clean and healthy, well, that might sound a little, what they call it, partisan tinged or colored language, because it just sounds, it's like bread and butter. It's like it's a feel good type of label. And so what does that actually mean?
So at this point, none of the citizen initiated constitutional amendments have gathered enough signatures. How long do they have to gather those?
They have until July 2026 to gather more than 100,000 signatures from voters. And I say more than 100,000, that's technically more than what they need, but most citizen groups will always collect more than what they need just in case there's an issue with a signature or with a page, the paperwork that goes along with it.
That was Kristen Ederstrom Higgins, Program Associate at the Public Policy Center for the University of Arkansas System Division of Agriculture, speaking with KUAF's Matthew Moore. For decades now, lethal injection has been the preferred method of execution in the U.S. While it's seen as more humane than other methods of the past, critics say it's far from perfect. Karina Barrett Lane is a professor of law at the University of Richmond School of Law and author of the book Secrets of the Killing State, The Untold Story of Lethal Injection. She spoke about it with Little Rock Public Radio's Nathan Treese.
So first of all, to start off, just tell me what brought you to write this book.
Well, I'm a death penalty researcher for nearly two decades now, and this project started with a research question, which was, why are states so bad at lethal injection? Why am I seeing three-hour executions and autopsies with 18 puncture wounds?
And so that led you here. The book covers the practice of executions via lethal injection, and that's over the last 45 years, so it covers a lot of ground. But let's start at the beginning. Can you tell us a little bit about the origins of the method? What led to it being adopted as the standard?
Sure. So lethal injection was invented in 1977, and the historical context is actually pretty important. The Supreme Court struck down the death penalty in 1972, as it was then practiced, and then brought it back in 1976. So 1976 marks what we call the modern era of capital punishment. And in 1976, the country had not seen an execution for 10 years. Legislators were very worried about the public's reaction to the sort of state violence that execution methods at the time entailed. All we had were the electric chair and death by the gas chamber, both of which are just gruesome deaths. And most people don't know this, but at the time, a federal court had recognized a First Amendment right to televise executions. Now, it wouldn't last, but nobody could have known that. And so legislators were very, very worried about what this would be like. I quote one who says, well, we can't have an electrocution in someone's living room. So they're very concerned about this. They're then thinking, well, what about a death by drugs? Fast forward to Oklahoma in 1977, and one of the legislators asks the state medical examiner, Dr. Jay Chapman. And Chapman refers to himself as an expert in dead bodies, but not in how to get them that way. But still, he comes up with the three-drug protocol. And I was very curious, how did how did he come up with the drugs? And I found an interview where he said, I didn't do any research. I just thought about what might be useful. And he said, you wanted two drugs. So if one, you know, didn't kill him, the other would. And the interviewer said, well, why did you add a third drug? And he said, why not? Why does it matter why I chose it? And that is how we got here.
Yeah, that's something that, you know, it is a little bit shocking reading the book, to say the least, to read how little oversight there was and to some extent still is, considering these executions. What would you say is the driving misconception behind the method of execution we know as lethal injection?
I think the main one is that people think this is a medicalized execution method where people just fall into forever sleep. And when you think about it, you know, it's all stagecraft. I thought there were doctors that were actually injecting the medicines. It's actually non-medical prison guards. But I think it all revolves around this aura of medicalization and a sense that there's care and competence that goes with it.
And you outline in the book some of the problems behind that, you know, mismatched medical equipment, things that the training is basically on the job, and there's no national standard. It's mostly just patchwork state by state. Thinking about that, you know, just this year, we here in Arkansas, the state legislature adopted hypoxia by nitrogen gas as an option for executions. And we kind of set that up following the examples of three other states. So I'm seeing there are some parallels with how we get into lethal injection versus nitrogen gas. How does that method compare to lethal injection?
I think really history is repeating itself, frankly. What we see with nitrogen gas is that at the very beginning, the first state to adopt nitrogen gas was Oklahoma. The other states followed Oklahoma. And what the legislators, the sponsors of the legislation in Oklahoma said is, and I'm quoting them, it's fast, it's painless. You just sit there a few minutes later and you're dead. It's foolproof. But we are gassing people to death. And I think it's very important that people understand that. And this nitrogen gas protocol was based on an unpublished 14-page paper, double-spaced, written by three liberal arts professors who had no medical training, no scientific backgrounds. And one of them gave an interview to the press and said, we probably talked about it for 3 hours. We just did the best we could. And that paper is so poorly written, so sloppy, that it actually spells wrong the name of one of the authors.
So the book was published in April of this year. So we're in a new administration now. And day one, priority for the administration, President Donald Trump renewed the focus on executions. He issued the executive order on restoring the death penalty. What is changing under this administration?
Simply put, the Trump administration is more death penalty, go for death, even when it has been constitutionally barred. Let's go ahead and challenge those constitutional rulings in court. So, you know, go for it even when you know it's not constitutional. However, if you want to know where the death penalty is really going, you don't look at executions, you look at death sentencing. Because today's death sentences are tomorrow's executions. And if you don't have death sentences feeding the machinery of death, the death penalty will die on the vine. You know, death sentencing is down over 80% in the past two decades. So 2004, there were 125 new death sentences around the country. 2024, the year for which we have the latest available data, 26. That's it. It's down for reasons that an executive order can't fix. It's down for reasons because people understand that we get these cases wrong. You know, we've executed 1,600 people in the modern era, a little over that. We've had 200 exonerations for death row. So for every 8 people we execute, there's one that we admit, oops, we got that one totally wrong. You know, people understand that. They understand racism. The defense attorneys are doing a better job at telling these people's stories. Death penalty support in Gallup is falling.
Put it this way, though. You've studied this for 45 years, and of course, executions have been around for about as long as we can remember in historic record. But in your view, is there such a thing as a humane execution?
Different people think about humane in different ways. Does that mean no pain? Does that mean least available pain? So what I talk about is non-torturous deaths, because lethal injection is so bad. I'm like, okay, can we just talk about not torturing people? And one of the things that I think about in answer to your question is saying I read, it's the heart stops reluctantly. And what this person was talking about is that until the body is ready to give up life on its own, it takes physical force. It takes violence to stop the heart from beating. It could be a car accident. It could be a homicide. It could be an execution, but it takes violence to stop the heart from beating. And so, you know, to your question, there will be violence because the heart stops reluctantly. And it's a question of whether we acknowledge that. And I think what lethal injection does is secretizes that violence so we don't think about it.
That was Karina Barrett Lane, author of the book Secrets of the Killing State, The Untold Story of Lethal Injection. She spoke with Little Rock Public Radio's Nathan Treese. An Arkansas civil rights leader is being remembered on what would have been her 111th birthday. A small celebration was held Tuesday at the longtime Little Rock home of Daisy Bates. A newspaper publisher and NAACP leader, Bates was an instrumental figure in the 1957 desegregation crisis at Little Rock Central High School. Larry Hicks is project manager at the Daisy Bates House National Historic Place. He says Bates' first priority was keeping the first 9 black students to attend Central High safe throughout the crisis.
With all of the tumult and all of the raucousness, all of the screaming, all of the shouting, there was never anybody killed. There was never anybody hung. There was never anybody who felt they were under serious threat. Now, was it a hostile and volatile area during that period of time? Absolutely it was.
Hicks says Bates' legacy deserves more attention than it sometimes receives.
People still have little understanding of what she represented and what she endured during that period of time. And it's up to us to be able to try and reinforce to others about how she made the difference in our ability to be able to better communicate with people of all stripes.
Hicks says telling the fraught story of the desegregation crisis and race relations in the South writ large is important work in today's day and age.
People are making it a point to really get an accurate view of exactly what happened, because in too many instances still to this day, people are hesitant to talk about it and the great toto of exactly what happened here in Little Rock during that period of time.
Bates died in Little Rock in 1999 at the age of 84. Her home in Little Rock's South End neighborhood was designated a National Historic Landmark by then-President Bill Clinton. In May 2024, she became only the third woman and third person of color to have their statue displayed in Statuary Hall at the U.S. Capitol. And that's it for this week. The Arkansas News Wrap is brought to you by the Arkansas Newsroom, a collaboration between KUAF in Fayetteville, KASU in Jonesboro, and Little Rock Public Radio. You can find this week's episode on any of our station's websites. Until next time, I'm Daniel Breen, and this is the Arkansas News Wrap.